Čakali, je to možná, probali si čekovat tu Harbison, aproximačně.
Okay, let me first thank the organizers for inviting me for a wonderful conference, I thought. And I hope so. We have still two talks. Okay, I will give you some background at first to what is complexity theory, because I was expecting not too many of you to know too much about this. And I'll repeat what Gil said last week when he was saying that everybody must be familiar with this. It's just don't worry. Eventually you get to the hard part. So, okay, suppose you have this following problem. You're supposed to organize a party. There are all these guests into the party. Some of them like each other and some of them don't. So you get this matrix of people who do like, pairs of people who like each other and don't like each other. And you're supposed to sit them around a table so that no pair... Yes, it was a matrix. Yes, it is symmetric. And you're supposed to sit them around the table so that no two that sit adjacent to each other do not like each other. So here you have this table, and suppose we try to sit John here, and this is fine for now. And then we decide to sit Mary here, and this is also fine because we see that they like each other. And then we decide to sit Bob here, and this is also fine because Bob and Mary do get along with each other. And we sit Alice here, and this is still fine. And we sit Jane here, and this is fine, and we only have to check that Jane and John do get along together, and this is still, again, okay. So we just set them to the table, and we were... Somehow it worked out. We just put them around, and they sat, and everything is fine. But what we're interested in general is a general mechanism, a general algorithm, some mechanical way to do that, so that we'll know whenever there is a way to sit them, we'll be able to do that. So what do you say is an algorithm for that? What would you do? So what we can do is just go over all the ordering of the guests around the table and check for each of them that whether it is okay. If one of them is okay, then fine. We just got the right ordering of the people around the table. And if not, we went over all of them and didn't find any that is good, then we say that there's no way to sit them around the table. Now, how long will this take? So how many permutations do we have of the guests around the table? So we have... If we have n guests, we have n minus 1 factorial. This is the number of orderings around the table. So to go over them, just to give you some idea of how much this will take, if we have 5 guests, then this is still okay. We have 24 different combinations to try. If it's 15 guests, then it's not really so nice. And if it's 100 guests, which is not such a large party, suppose it's a conference, and you have to sit 100 people in the conference, it's not so much, then look, this will take you, with the fastest computer that we have today, this will take you some 3 to the 10 to the 1 to the 30, 38 years, which is something like more than 10 to the 100 times the time the universe exists. So if unless the guests are very late, you're not going to be able to find the placing in time. So this is really not feasible. What I'm saying is, we all know what are exponential functions, but I'm trying to show that this is really the case that once you go into exponential complexity, then you have no hope of even solving problems where you have only 100 different bits. Here you have actually 10,000 bits because you need to have all the pairs. Okay, let's look at another problem. Suppose you go to a city and you try to visit all the places in the city and you have some subway connections between the different parts. And you're trying to find a tour through all the sites that will pass every one of them just once. So can you do it in this case? Anyone see that? Anyone see that now? Well, so is there a way to go over all the sites and visit them? And still this problem, we have the same problem. If we just do backtracking and try all the possible ways to cover all the cities, this will take exponential time. This is rather bad. So the main question we ask in complexity theory is whether a problem is tractable, whether there's an efficient solution for it, or whether it's not. So there are two good answers to this question. One of them, yes, here is an algorithm that solves this problem efficiently. That's good. The other one is no. But I don't have an algorithm, and I can prove to you that there's no algorithm that solves this problem unless it uses a very long time. The problem with this is that we don't know anything. There's almost no proof of this sort. This is what we call lower bound, computational lower bound. And we know, take the simplest computational model you have, for all we know, it could solve all the problems, even in NP. Almost all problems. So here comes the problem. Suppose you're given this problem, somebody asks you to solve this, to arrange the people in the party, and you don't find a solution, or say another problem, you know, you have many problems in this party, and you can't find a solution, but you can't prove that there's no solution. So what will you do? And here comes a solution that would be, before that I'll tell you some other things. So what we consider first is the growth function. The complexity function we consider is how complex the problem is compared to the number, how long will it take, or how much memory it will take, with respect to the length of the input. So we have the input length and the time, and we consider some linear function like 10n as some plausible solutions. Even n squared we can consider as a plausible solution, although sometimes n squared is already too much. But for our purposes for now, for the gross divide, we consider this as still tractable. When we have 2 to the n number of operations, this is really too much. Not only that it grows as fast as I showed you, but then suppose you have a computer which is 1,000 times faster than your computer that you have today. And still, if you just enlarge your input by 10 bits, this will still will already run at the same speed it ran on the older computer. So exponential growth is really, really very bad, and we have some factorial, which is even worse than that, if we have n factorial. And the deviation we make between problems are those that are tractable, reasonable solution, like polynomial time, n to some constant power, and those that are unreasonable that have exponential time solution. This is the main distinction we make in complexity theory. So now we have all these problems, and we don't know how to solve them, but we don't know to show that there's no solution. So what can we do? Is there a way that we can actually somehow relate the complexity of the two problems? So we have the sitting problem, sitting around the table, and then tool problem. Is there some relation between them? So it turned out that there is, and it's actually very simple. What we do, this is what we call reduction. This will be a very simple reduction. That if you assume an efficient procedure for one of the problems, it is possible that we will be able to solve efficiently the other problem. This would mean that we reduce the complexity, the hardness of one problem, to the hardness of the other. And then we say that this problem B that we've reduced to cannot be radically harder than A, because if we reduce from B to A. Right? This is when we solve. Let's see. So we assume an efficient procedure for A, and using it, we solve a problem B, which is saying that we reduce the problem B to the problem A. And this means that B cannot be much harder than A, because if it were much harder than A, we could have used A to solve it. And this is how we denote it. B lesser or equal to P to A. And then we say that A is at least as hard as B. Okay, so let's try to find out some reduction from one of the problems to the other. So actually, there is quite a simple... These problems actually look the same, and most of you know that, and one of them is a Hamiltonian cycle, and the other is a Hamiltonian path. So there is a very simple way to reduce one to the other. If you look at two sides and you see that they are directly reachable from one another, we can think of each side, assign it a guest in the party, and then say that the two like each other. And what we do is add another very popular guest to the party that gets along with everyone. And we have a reduction. What we do is add this other guest, and then if we have a path from going through all of the site, and we have a cycle sitting people through the table because we put the popular guest at the end of the table, and once we get some Hamiltonian cycle, a cycle going through all the vertices in this graph, we can just delete it and get an Hamiltonian path. So we know that the sitting problem is at least as hard as a tour problem. And let me just tell you what we've shown. We've shown some reduction. This was the first reduction, a very simple reduction. We show that we can translate one problem to another efficiently, which means that the second one cannot be much harder than the first one. Let me skip to this. Now the point is that we have a huge class of problems. It contains a thousand of problems, and all reducible to the others, and for which we know exponential time algorithms, but we don't know any efficient algorithms. This is what's called the NP-complete class. It's just these problems in NP that are also hard for NP. So every problem in NP can be reduced to these problems. So let me make the point precise. Many maybe have heard of NP. NP is not really a model of computation. It's an imaginary model of computation. We say that if we had some magical power and be able to guess some certificate for the solution of a problem, we would have been able to solve the problem very easily. But this is not the case in any practical model of computation. The only reason that NP and NP complete problems are important because there are so many of them, and so many problems that come up in everyday life turn out to be NP complete, and therefore we know that all these problems are somehow connected together. They are either all of them solvable, have efficient algorithm, or none of them does. Okay, so now here's a big million-dollar question. So I claim that the P versus NP is really much more essential than people sometimes exaggerate. It's not only that this is the most fundamental problem in computer science, whether P is equal to NP, so finding an efficient solution to one of these NP-complete problems. It will be, of course, a great honor, but also you can get quite some money because there's a prize on it. This is the first prize and the first million-dollar prize on the list of the Clay Math Institute. But also, this has much greater philosophical implication, because really this would mean that there's no need for human ingenuity. So if somebody asks you to go and, you know, design a car that meets some criteria, you have to be ingenious, you have to find this and how to do that. But if NP were equal to a P, then there's no need for that. You just plug into the computer all of the requirements, and it comes up with the best solution. If P is equal to N. And if that doesn't scare you, then the next one will. So there's really no need for mathematicians, because now what we'll do is just plug in, you know, type in your favorite mathematical theorem, and if there is a short proof for it, then the computer will come up with it, and then you'll just have the proof. You don't even know, they have to read the proof. You just have to know that what is true and what's not.
Anyway,
why not?
If people like to say this, not implies this, because data you should put in is too large. And so
too large? So you mean you want the theorem which is too large to put in the computer? Okay, let me rephrase it.
If you transport it to data, it's so big that it anyway. It may be the P for a P, and we don't have...
okay, maybe. Okay, maybe. Okay, so let me just... this was sort of an introduction, not that this will not be an introduction, but let me just define a new, really basic problem. This is constraint satisfaction. So here's the instance. We are given a set of constraints over some variables. There are two types of variables, X variables and Y variables, we have some range, Rx and Ry, and we have these constraints. The constraints are what I call determinate. So what they do is look at the variable x, see its value, that determines the value of another variable y, and they make sure that this is indeed the case. So each of these constraints, we denote it phi of x to y, because x determines the value of y. So it's a function, it's a determinate function from Rx to Ry, and it requires that the value of x matches the value of y. So if you look at x, you know exactly what is the value of y that is necessary in order to satisfy this phi x to y. And let's add some uniformity condition, which will help us along the way if we manage to get that far. So we require each of the x variables to appear in the same number of constraints, and also for the y variables to appear in the same number of constraints. So we call it dx and dy. And this is the number of appearance. Now we need to optimize. What do we need to optimize? We need to get the largest number possible of constraints satisfied. So we're going to assign values to all the x variables and all the y variables. To the x variable, we'll assign values in Rx, and to the y variables, we'll assign values in Ry. And we require to satisfy as many as possible of the constraints. So here, this is how I'll denote the assignments from x to Rx, from y to Ry, and the fraction of phi that is satisfied, this is the parameter. We call it epsilon of phi. So it's a max sat of phi. Okay, is it clear what the problem? This is really a basic problem we'll use. This is some alternative definition of the sat problem you might have seen. And okay, so the first way we could attack NP was Cook's characterization of NP. What he showed is that this problem, the CSP problem, is NP hard. So let me be precise. To distinguish between the case that there is an assignment that satisfies all of the constraints of this constraints as CSP instance, given an instance, and the case where no assignment satisfies all of them, this is NP hard. This is really Cook's characterization of NP. And we know that since this CSP problem is NP hard, then testing membership in L reduces to CSP. So whatever you give me, any language in NP, I take it and I efficiently can construct a CSP instance that will be satisfied if and only if the input that I've began with is in L. And in general, take any problem now in NP. We know that by Cook's theorem that we can reduce it to CSP. And now, in order to show that some other problem is NP hard, we only need to show reduction from CSP to that problem. Right, you just have one canonical example of a problem which is NP complete. And now take that problem and efficiently reduce it to any other problem to show that the other problem is NP hard. Okay? Okay, so let's see an example. Let's show that max independent set is NP hard. So what is max independent set? We are given a graph G and a goal, a threshold K. We just need to decide whether there is an independent set in this graph of size k at least. And an independent set is a set of vertices with no edges between them. So in this case, we do have some independent set of four vertices in this graph that we've seen here. And we want to show that this problem is NP-hard, so we'll reduce CSP to this problem. So we take an instance of CSP with all these constraints and reduce it to max independent set. Here's a graph that we construct, given a CSP instance. So it comprises of, for every variable x, in capital X, we have a clique whose size is Rx. It has one vertex for every possible assignment to x. These are the vertices. So we have k will be the number of variables in x, and these are the possible assignments. And an edge in this graph corresponds to inconsistency. So two assignments of x, they might determine the same y. And if they determine different values for the same y, they'll be inconsistent. Mm, never mind this. So now we know, look at this graph, and we know that if we have an independent set of size k must contain exactly one vertex in each of these cliques, because it cannot contain two, and it is of size k. And given an assignment that satisfies all of the constraints, we can come up with an independent set in this graph with one vertex in each clique. On the other hand, if we have an independent set of size k with one vertex in each clique, we can get from it an assignment that satisfies all of the constraints. Okay, so this was the first not so trivial reduction that we've seen. Now we know that independent set is NP hard. Now comes the next question. So suppose we take the tool problem that we had before, and now we assign values, costs, to each of these edges. So I ask you not for a tour around all of the vertices, but the cheapest one, the one that goes through all of the cities, all of the sites, and the sum of the weights over all the edges is the smallest. And since this problem is NP-hard, I didn't show you that, but it's easy to show that this is NP-hard, and the next question is whether we can approximate it. So we can't come up with the best solution, but maybe we can somehow approximate it, come up with a solution which is twice as more expensive as the shortest one. And here comes the other part of this talk. We want to show the hardness of approximation. So we'll be, it would be good if we will be able to show that this problem is in fact NP-hard. But not only that coming up with a shorter solution, with a cheaper solution, is NP-hard, but also coming up with a solution which is twice as more expensive than the cheapest one. If this were NP-hard, you would know not to try to tackle this problem anymore. Okay, so for this, I'll introduce a gap problem, which are promise problems. Let me just say what is a promise problem. You're given an input, and you have some promise on the input. You know that you don't care about some inputs. You only care if the size of, say, here's an example. You're given a graph in which you know that there's a clique of size n over 4, a quarter of the graph, and you just ask the algorithm to tell you whether there is a clique of size n over 2. That's a promise problem. We know that the graph contains a clique of n over 4. That's a promise, and we have to solve the problem still. This problem, so we don't care whether the algorithm, what does the algorithm do when the clique size, the maximal clique size in this graph is less than n over 4. That's a promise problem. And we'll see what this, it's a gap problem. I'll just show you the gap problem, and then it will be easier to see. We have an instance, and then what the algorithm needs to do is just there's some maximization, some optimization parameter. And the algorithm needs to return a bit, yes or no, and to say yes when the value optimized is larger than B, and no when it's less than A. And we don't care what it is say if it's between A and B. That's a gap problem. So we've seen some reductions showing NP hardness of some regular problem. What about approximation? Why not, in order to prove that some approximation problem are NP hard, find a canonical example, a gap problem, and then reduce from it. And what we call a gap-preserving reduction. So we'll take a gap problem and reduce it to another gap problem, and then we'll take a canonical one, and then, therefore, we'll show that the other problem is NP-hard even to approximate. So here's a canonical example. It's not very far from what we've seen. It's what we call the gap CSP with a parameter epsilon. The instance is the same as before. We're just given a constraint satisfaction, the same as I defined a few slides ago. And the problem is the algorithm must say yes when there is an assignment satisfying all the constraints, and must say no when there's no assignment satisfying even epsilon of the constraints. So there's a gap. This is what we call the gap problem. So the mu epsilon of phi is either 1 or smaller than epsilon. This is all we care about. And the algorithm needs to return this bit, whether it's higher, at least 1, or smaller than epsilon. In all the range in between, the algorithm can return whatever result it would like. And this will be our canonical NP-hard problem. Let's see what it is. This is what's called the PCP theorem. And it says that this is indeed NP-hard. So as long as you take Rx and Ry and be large enough, polynomial in epsilon, in 1 over epsilon, then this problem is still NP-hard. So it's strengthening Cook's characterization of NP in that way. So that even doing that, distinguishing between the case that all of the constraints are satisfiable and the case that less than epsilon of them are satisfiable, this is still NP-hard. And we want to use this problem to show hardness of approximation. So let me skip this, why this is called PCP. It's a nice story, but we don't have time for it. And let's go back to max independence set. So let's just take the same reduction we already seen. Will it give us anything? Now assuming the PCP theorem that should tell us that it is the gap version of CSP is still NP-hard, can we use the same reduction to show that approximating max independence set is still NP-hard? Well, it turns out that it is. Just use the same reduction. So still, a satisfying assignment will give us an independent set of size k, 1 in each clique. On the other hand, if we are given an independent set of size epsilon k, you don't see it because it doesn't show everything, but if you're given an independent set of size epsilon k, we can, by it, produce an assignment to the CSP instance that we have, to all of the variables. It will satisfy epsilon fraction, at least epsilon fraction of the constraint. So therefore, if we started with an instance in which there was no assignment satisfying epsilon fraction of the constraints, we'll come up with a graph in which there's no epsilon k size independent set. So therefore, approximating the size of the independent set is also already NP-hard. Okay? So this is the corollary, that independent set is hard to approximate within any constant because epsilon was any constant you would like. Okay, we'll skip some more. Now we'll get to something which is more related to this the theme of the conference. And this is linear equations. Suppose now we want to show the following NP-hardness result. We are given a set of linear equations over GF2, mod 2, and say that even each of these equations has exactly three variables. So it's three variables, it just takes a sum of three variables, and you want it to be either equal 0 or equal 1. And your problem, the optimization problem, is to find the assignments that satisfy most of the linear equations, as many as possible of them. So this is the instance. Is that clear? We just get a system of linear equation over GF2, three variables in each. We want to compute the assignment that satisfy as many as possible of them. And a theorem due to Hostad is that it is NP-hard to distinguish between the case that there's an assignment satisfying one minus epsilon fraction of the equations and the case that no assignment satisfies more than half plus epsilon of the equations. This is still NP-hard. Let me say it in another way. You're just giving the system of equations and you are asked just to give one bit, to say one bit, whether almost all of them are satisfiable, and this is true for any epsilon, any constant epsilon larger than zero, whether almost all of them are satisfiable, or whether just a little bit more than half are satisfiable, and still, this is NP-hard. If you can solve this, you can solve any problem in NP. Which means that you cannot approximate this problem to within a factor of 2. And now this bound is tight. Let me just say quickly why it's tight. I don't want to get too much into it, but a random assignment for these linear equations satisfy half of the equations. So So there must be an assignment satisfying half of the equation. And deciding whether all of them are satisfiable is in P, by just Gaussian elimination. So this is really, there's no, up to what epsilon is, it could be smaller than a constant, there's no better result that you can have. And let me outline the proof. We'll do a reduction, as before. We'll just take the CSP. This is known to be hard for any epsilon larger than zero, any constant. And we'll produce, in polynomial time, construct a set of linear equations such that if we begin with an instance phi of constraint satisfaction problem in which all of the equations are satisfiable, we'll get a linear system, a system of linear equations in which almost all of them are satisfiable. And if we begin with an instance phi in which less than epsilon is satisfiable, we'll end up with this instance of the linear equations in which not more than half plus epsilon L are satisfiable. Let me tell you the main idea of this reduction. The main idea is that you take each of these variables, x and y, and you replace them with a new set of variables. These variables will be over GF2, so they'll just have 0 and 1 value. And each of the variables will correspond to one bit of a binary encoding, a binary code, over the value that this variable x or y should have been assigned. And what we'll do, which is sort of magical, that you can do actually all that, not that magic, what we'll do, okay, I guess, so we take every variable x of range Rx and every variable y of range Ry, and we replace them with a set of bits, each of these bits corresponding to one bit of a binary code of the value to the variables. And somehow magically, we take 3 bits from all of these, we take linear equations, each of them looking at 3 bits, only 3 bits, and just using those 3 bits manages to verify that each of these codes is indeed consistent in some way, correspond to roughly one possible value. And not only that whenever we have x and y that should correspond, the values should correspond to each other, it also verifies that these values are consistent. And I'll show you some of the magic of how to do that, and then you'll see where Fourier analysis of these Boolean functions comes into the picture. So the binary code we'll use is the long code. It's called the long code because it's the longest code. It's the most extensive binary code you can have. It contains every bit that any binary code might contain. So if you want to encode one element out of a set of set R, these, let's think of those as there are different elements that you want to encode. So this is a set. What you do is you have one bit in the encoding for every subset of those elements. So this is one subset. It's a singleton containing the leftmost element. Here, this is one bit of the binary code. Here we have another subset, the second singleton from the left. This is also a legitimate subset. And here we have another subset with those two elements, another subset of these elements, and another subset. We just have one bit for every subset of elements. Now let's see what are the legal code words of this binary code. So if you want to encode that element over there, what we do, we just have define the legal code word, we just say what is the value each bit of this bit of the code is assigned. So in this case, what do you think? This subset does not contain this element, and therefore the value will be 0. This subset does not contain the element, and again the value will be 0. This subset does contain the element, so the value will be 1. What? This value this subset does contain the element, so it's 1, and this one also contains the element, so it's 1. So you're given this set of bits, you look at an element of R, and you just assign the values to each subset according to whether it contains that element or not. So let me just tell you now what are the variables of L phi. I already said it, but let me just be more precise. So we are given the sense instance phi. So we know that there's a gap. It is either satisfiable completely or less than epsilon of the constraints are satisfiable. Now we have two types of variables. One of them is for the y variables and one of them for the x variables. So every y variable, an f, a subset of ry, the domain that we try to encode, will have one bit, one variable of this linear equation system. And also for every x, and a subset of rx, will have a bit in this variable, in this linear equation. And these are all the variables we'll have. We're just now going to construct the constraints on these bits in some clever way. And just a remark, which will be really hard to see, we actually have half of these bits. So this is what we call the folded long code. So we assume that the values we give to a subset F is just the opposite of the value we give to the complement of that subset. We can assume that because we can just give one bit to both and just interpret it as 1 or minus 1 depending on how do we read this. This comes out in the calculation, but I'm not sure we'll get there so far, so it's not so important. Okay, now we're going to design some system of linear equations. So first of all, let's see what can we say about the linearity of this legal encoding of the long code. So I say that they are linear in the sense that if you take any function from all the subsets to Z2, to GF2, if it is a legal code word, then it is a linear function. That is, if you take two subsets, F and G, and look at the value that F gives to the subset capital F, and F gives to G, then it is equal, mod 2, to the symmetric difference between F and G. This must be the case, right? If we just take two subsets, the value of them is either 0 or 1, and this is really the indicator function. So this is a good place to start. We know that if we apply this linearity test on these random subsets, then it will always hold as long as F, the binary code, the binary word that we get, is a legal encoding. The problem with this is that there are many other functions that passes this test with probability 1. In fact, these are all the characters of these functions. Every one of them is a every sum of subsets of variables is also a linear function, of course. And it will pass the test with probability 1. So we have to design a better test than that. And this is where the fun really begins. What we do is we look at the perturbation subset. So this is really a simple definition. We just take H to be a subset chosen in the following way. We have a parameter lambda. We flip a coin with probability lambda for each. We flip a coin for every element of R or Rx that we try to choose H from. With probability lambda, it flips heads. And then the element will be in the subset. With probability 1 minus lambda, the element will be out of the subset. So this is really product distribution of lambda bias distribution. And let's see what we do with this. Forget about this. This is a not so important remark. The linear equation that we'll have is for every constraint phi. Phi is defining x and y. It's not written there, but it should be. What we do, and for every subset f and of ry, subset g of rx, what we do is look at the sum of f in the long code of y, g in x, and instead of doing what we did before, which is looking at f as a symmetric difference between F and G, what we do is we perturb it by H. So its probability lambda, each of these elements, is going to be changed here. And this somehow does the work for us. This is really, this, as I don't have time to go into this, but this H subset, this perturbation, is really related to Bechner's operator. So what Bechner does, he says that for this lambda, what you do is perturb the function and take the average over all the epsilon ball. It's sort of a ball that you get around the value. And what Bechner inequality does, it tells you that the norm of that function, the average function, is controls the norm of the function itself, but with a different norm. So this is really what you get from it. So here what we do is actually test it. So instead of just doing the straightforward test of just testing F and G and then the symmetric difference of F and G, what we do is perturb it by H, and then this will give us the desired outcome. So let's actually go through the calculation. You'll see, somehow you'll see maybe how does this come into. Okay, so first of all, the correctness of this reduction. It should be clear that if we started with phi, which is satisfiable completely, there's a way to satisfy all these constraints, then the set of linear equations is almost completely satisfiable. Only lambda fraction of them will not be satisfiable. And this lambda is exactly when H, the perturbation subset, just hit the element which correspond to the true assignment to these x variables. This is really simple to see, so let me go on. The really important part is to show that if there is a way to satisfy significantly more than half of the equations, then it must be the case that we can satisfy a constant fraction of phi. Now, here comes also the connection to all of the themes that we've seen, where is the large dimension phenomenon. So the main point about this parameter here, how much phi is satisfied, is that it's 4 lambda delta squared, and delta is just twice success probability minus 1. So it's just a difference from half multiplied by 2. And the main point of this about this is that this does not depend on epsilon. You see, the epsilon of the CSP, the parameter, is not mentioned here. So really what happens is that we get some probability of success which is constant relative to epsilon. In order to derive our result, what we do is make epsilon very, very small as necessary. This will be much larger than those parameters. Epsilon 1 minus epsilon will be much larger than those parameters. It will make the size of the domain much larger. And still, the probability that we get here is constant. So let me just try to go through the analysis. So we're given an assignment to all of these variables of L phi. What we do is think of it as a function, instead of function of 0, 1, as function minus 1 and 1. This is just the usual transformation from linear functions to product function, to multiplicative functions. And then take every of these long code with the note f of x, which is a function from this, all the subset of Rx to minus 1 and 1. This is the same function as we get by the assignment. And f of y is this function here. So I just denoted f of x and f of y. And what we're going to do is give a distributional assignment to the variable of phi. So before we considered assignments to phi that give just one value to each variable. What we'll do here, we can think of, instead of assigning one value, assigning a distribution over all the possible values. Just take any distribution over Rx or Ry and assign it to the variable. Then we can denote mu of lambda of phi as the average over all the distributional assignments of the average of the probability of success of that phi. And it turns out, which I don't have time to show, that these two parameters are exactly equal. This is very easy. This is also not so complicated. But we can just look at distributional assignment. This is for a technical reason you'll see in a minute. The distributional assignment that we give to a phi is the following. Take every x, every variable x, look at f of x. This is a Boolean function. Now choose a subset of Rx according to f hat square of s, the Fourier coefficient of the subset s squared, and the important point is that for such functions, the square of the coefficients is really a distribution because the sum of the squares is 1 because of Parseval inequality. And therefore, this gives us a distribution over a subset. Then what we do is choose one element of this subset uniformly, and we do the same for y. And we claim that this distribution, this distributional assignment, gives us success probability. Wow. Well, I guess this is another use of this outlet. This distributional assignment is give us that probability of success. Now, okay, let me just skip through this. I'll show you the main part of this calculation, which is this. What we do is try to figure out, this is the success, the expectation of this function. So it's fy of f and g and f xor g xor h. And the thing is that we can just write it according to the Fourier transform, and then we put out all of the Fourier coefficients, have the expectation here, then takes the expectation and divide it according to the subset F, G, and H, and what we get here that these two expectations become zero unless Sx equal Sx prime. It's not exactly Sx prime, but I don't have time for it, and Sy equal Sx prime, so the only factor that, and otherwise it is 1, so the only factor we have to put in is to consider Sx n, where Sy and Sx prime are the same, and this expectation here, since we have the H variable chosen according to this perturbation, the bias probability, and it's a product, then it's 1 minus 2 lambda to the size of the character S of X, which really is a crust of the matter because it tells us that all of the distribution, all of the coefficients, almost all of them, almost all of them are concentrated on small coefficients, or small characters, characters that are not too large, and thereby we get this desired property. I haven't told you what odd is, but never mind. Let me just sum up. So, I didn't show you some other uses of this Fourier analysis of Boolean functions. Okay, 1 minute is enough for this. But what Dinur and I did is show that the vertex cover is hard to approximate, and for that we had to use Friedrich's lemma that show that functions, Boolean functions with low average sensitivity are epsilon close to a function junta, which is a function that depends only on a small number of variables. And this is related to other possible results for hardness of approximation. It's a result, a fascinating recent result by Bourguin, showing that any Boolean function, so that the Fourier weight on frequencies higher than k is small, must be itself also close to a junta, a function that depends only on a constant number of variables. And there's some other references that I can just put here and correlated to all of these very important parameters of Boolean functions, the average sensitivity, the Friedrich lemma, the high frequency weight, the noise sensitivity, they're all related. So let me stop here.
Thank you. Questions? Okay, so let's thank the speaker again.